All right, we are in Daniel 6. Daniel 6. Now, we have had a change in administration. The last two verses of the previous chapter, it says, "In that night, Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, was slain, and Darius the Median took the kingdom, being about 62 years old." The end of the Babylonian Empire that was largely built by Nebuchadnezzar has come to a stop. And the administration has been switched to the Persians. Now, there's a couple of interesting things here. I think last time we talked about how the great city of Babylon was taken by the Persians. They rerouted the Euphrates River and then that flowed under the wall and through the city. And the water was shallow enough then for the soldiers to wade through the water and also walk under the wall. And so they came into the city and immediately went to the palace, took out the king, and the city was largely taken before the guards on the wall knew what was going on. And so they just surrendered. The city was not destroyed. It would last for hundreds of years. We saw some pictures a few weeks back of the existing ruins there in Babylon. There's quite a bit still standing. Which leads me to believe, well, I'm not going to chase this one real far, but leads me to believe that some of the prophecies regarding the destruction of Babylon that are listed in the prophets are not referring to anything that's happened in the past. And one of the things that is gaining some traction is the idea that maybe Babylon will be rebuilt. And I know that Saddam Hussein had that as a goal. He was hoping to rebuild the city of Babylon and recreate the Babylonian Empire, if you will. It's a fascinating thing. If you go to Greece, Aaron and I had the privilege of going to Greece over 25 years ago, and at the time they were transitioning in toward the euro, but they still had their own coinage, and they had Alexander the Great on some of their coins. And our tour guide talked a lot about Alexander the Great. And I'm thinking to myself, if the best you guys have to offer is a leader of your country that's been gone for 2,400 years, you know, you're really stretching it. And I was talking to somebody this past week. The folks in Iran revel in Cyrus the Great today. And he was the founder and leader of the Persian Empire, and he is like their hero, and he's even older than Alexander. So this king that we have here is problematic for a lot of folks. Now I'm gonna pause here for a moment, and I know that Sam is going to be following what I'm saying, and he's going to be interested in this, and some of the rest of you are going to be sitting there going, what's this? You know, they're going to be the deer in the headlights kind of thing, and some of you may be following. If you read commentators, if you have a study Bible that has extensive notes, they will have information, way too much information on who is Darius the Mede. Now, let's back up a little bit. Daniel is there. He is a first-hand eyewitness to what is going on. He is simply declaring what's going on around him. He does not have a political axe to grind. He is not a Babylonian. He is not a Chaldean. He is Jewish. He is a captive from way, way, way before. But he has been exceedingly helpful to the Chaldeans. Since the city was easily captured, they simply changed the administration of the thing, implemented a number of the aspects of Persian law as opposed to Babylonian law, and probably kept a lot of the previous folks there since they knew how to keep this well-oiled machine going, making the adjustments. We have a change in the king. The big debate is who in the world is Darius the Mede? We know from reading your Bible, we know from a number of secular sources that the Medes and the Persians are two different groups that combined as allies. At the beginning, you'll always see the Medes listed first, and later on the Persians are mentioned first, or even the Medes just drop out altogether. But throughout their history, they remained allies. The question is, who is the king? There have been four major views on who Darius the Mede is. Like I said, Daniel just tells you this guy is he's Darius the Mede, and he's 62 years old when he comes in with the overthrow of Babylon. No details on his background, doesn't list who his father was, doesn't say anything, and doesn't say anything about Belshazzar either. Because Daniel is just telling the events that are going on around him. It's not a political expose on the latest and greatest in his day. He's dealing with bigger and greater things. I will tell you what the different options are, and then I'll tell you what I think are the more likely ones. I will also tell you this. If you go to a number of the museums around the world, you go to the British Museum, you go to there's some museums in Germany, you go to the museums that are there in Iraq, you go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City, you go to a number of different places, and they will have clay tablets written in cuneiform. Which means you had a little thing, a little stylus, and they're pressing little wedges into this, and that was how they wrote on these things, and they were on clay tablets. And if it was a really important document, they would bake it so that it would last. They have uncovered thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of these cuneiform tablets. And there are people that could read these things. And so we have loads and loads of information about what life was like in Babylon under the Babylonians. We have a little bit of information that is written in the Babylonian languages and so on in the cuneiform tablets during the Persian era, but just a little bit. The Persians wrote all their documents. Remember what we're going to see if you read the book of Ezra, and the Cyrus the king had issued a declaration that they were to go rebuild the temple. And then over a period of time, he dies, and there's the construction comes to a halt. Then you have the preaching of the prophets Haggai and Zechariah. They start rebuilding the temple again. And the adversaries say, well, who said you could do this? And they said, Cyrus told us. And so they keep building while a messenger goes all the way across over to Persia, gives them this news, and then they have to try to find the record of Cyrus's proclamation. And they found it. And it says there was a roll, and it mentions the name of the city. I think it was Ecbatana and so on. And they find this thing, and they find it on a scroll. The Persians did not evidently write on the little clay tablets. They wrote on leather scrolls. Now, what's going to last longer? We're talking about dealing with hundreds and thousands of years. What's going to last longer, a clay tablet or a leather scroll? The clay tablet. Clay tablet isn't as convenient on the short term, but if you're looking at preserving something for some archaeologist to dig up 2,500 years later, it comes in really handy. What happens to the leather scrolls? Unless you're dealing with a super duper duper dry climate like Egypt, what happens to the leather scrolls? It rots away over a period of time. It gets brittle, comes and falls to pieces, and the bugs eat it. Okay. This is why they have virtually nothing written by the Medes about themselves. There's no existing records about them. There are a few inscriptions on mountainsides and things like that of the Persians. But there's very, very little even by the Persians. So how do we know all this stuff about Persian history outside of the Bible? We have the Bible record. How do we know other things about the Persians? All right. When we get further in, we're going to be dealing, matter of fact, the next chapter, we dealt with this also with the image in chapter 2. We have the head of gold who was Nebuchadnezzar. We have the chest of silver, which is the Persian Empire. The Persian, and then we have the loins of bronze. They represent what empire? The Greeks. So the Persians were succeeded by the Greeks, Alexander the Great in particular. And then eventually the Greeks were superseded by the Romans. The Greeks wrote extensively. They wrote about the Persians. Not necessarily at the same time, they wrote as it was history. So they wrote 100, 150 years later. And they didn't like the Persians for the most part. And they had a prejudice against them. And even the ones that like some of the Persians, they're not dealing, it's all political jockeying. You're not getting objective history. You have history written for a purpose, which means it's got a slant on it. It's got an angle. It's prejudicial. And we have two main Greek historians. Now I'm going to butcher the names because I hear them pronounced. We have Herodotus and we have another guy named Xenophon. That's with an X. Xenophon. And both of these guys wrote over 100 years after the fact. They're Greeks. And they don't agree with each other, even though they're talking about the same events. And so they have, and because the Persians didn't leave anything that tells us about themselves, we are largely dependent on what the Greeks said in order to find out anything about the Persians. Now, of course, we could always just go to the Bible and we could piece together a lot of it just from the scripture. But secular historians discount the scripture, even though the scripture is always right, historically, and on anything else for that matter, but historically it's always right. And so they sit there and they try, and they also find some of these tablets and they find a few other things, some allusions and stuff like that. And so they try to figure out who in the world is Darius the Mede? Because according to one of the Greek historians, Cyrus was the guy who captured Babylon. And according to the other guy, it wasn't Cyrus. According to one guy, Cyrus conquered the Medes and forced them to become his allies. And the other one, the guy, married a Median princess and ended up inheriting the throne later on. Which one's right? The Bible doesn't say on some of those details. We don't have any information outside of those two guys that really give us definitive answers. So we're left with some conjecture as to who these people are. Some will say that Darius the Mede is actually Cyrus. I don't think that one has a whole lot of... there's problems with that. There was another one that Darius the Mede is actually the general who was under Cyrus, and he's the guy that actually led the military forces to conquer Babylon. And there was a really, really good guy that espoused that, but I don't think he was right. And the reason he got a lot of attraction is because he was a really, really good guy. But I don't think he was right on this area. There was a very old view that fell into... people began to set it aside, but it's gained some traction again. And that is that the last king of the Medes was not Astyages, the father-in-law of Cyrus... father-in-law of Cyrus, but rather Astyages actually had a son who didn't last real long, and he didn't have any sons. And so when he died, Cyrus took over. And so that guy's name is Cyaxares, and that this guy is actually Cyaxares. It makes sense, and it fits Daniel better, and that's also what Xenophon said. So it agrees with Xenophon. And it fits the biblical record. My personal view is that that one's a good possibility, and the other one is that we just don't have enough information. But whatever the case is, we got a guy who's 62 years old. He is the king because he makes a decree. He's not a governor. He is the king. He is able to make a decree. Now, with the change, so we're going to go to the next stage here. With the change in administration, when we go from the Babylonians to the Persians had some idiosyncrasies in their law. We see this in Esther. We get a hint of it in the book of Ezra as well. That when it's very much so here in Daniel. that when the Persians made a law, when a Persian king made a law and he pressed his seal in there and it's all official, the king himself couldn't change the law. Now, in Babylon, under Nebuchadnezzar and so on, he did what he wanted to. He could change his mind. He's an absolute monarch. He was bound by nothing but his own will. The Persians are bound by law. Yes, they were absolute monarchs, but once they made a decision, they were stuck with it. Now you think, that's a dumb thing to do. What if you made some tragic mistake and you couldn't undo it? Well, that happened several times. As a matter of fact, in Esther, that was the big problem. How do we undo what Haman does? And so we have these issues of Persian law. Why did they have that in the first place, by the way? Why in the world did they come up with something like that? All right, it's mostly the second one. We're going to be very careful. And also, I'm a king. I don't make mistakes. Now, they did. But it's the idea. So we're going to be very careful. Don't you wish our government was this way? That they very carefully read through everything before they voted or signed off on it. This is a good way to keep things simple and make sure that everything is just very straightforward and understandable so we don't run into some hiccups and difficulties down the road. Change in administration, and also the Persians had typically three different palaces that they cycled in depending on what time of year it was. They went to the place that had the nicest climate, all right, here in Washington. We are getting to that time of year, depending on who they are. Some do it before the holidays, some do it right after the holidays, but we have a lot of what we call rain birds around here that fly south for the winter. All right, and they'll go to Arizona or California or something like that. When I lived out east, we had snowbirds, and they all flew off to Florida to spend the winter. My grandparents did that for a number of years. They flew off to Florida and spent the winter in Sarasota. And so the Persians, because it was so beast, they had a palace up in the mountains. And the problem was that if you're at 5,000 or 6,000 feet in elevation, in this particular latitude, when winter comes, you don't have central heat. It's cold. It's uncomfortable. It's a great place to spend the summer. Got some cool breezes here. It's in the 60s and 70s. I'm enjoying myself. Maybe a hot day would be in the 80s. We've got trees around. We're up in the mountains and so on. It's a great place to spend the summer. When it began to cool off, and they would go to where it was the warmest. And so they would spend their winters in Babylon. And again, that's just a little bit south of Baghdad today. And then they had another palace that they went to in the springtime before they went up to the mountains finally. So they had this rotation that they would go through. So here we have a guy who's probably in Babylon. And he is a Persian. And he's new. They're having to redo the government a little bit. They're going to use the same people, but they're going to juggle it around to fit the model that the Persians have. It says in verse 1, it pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 princes that should be over the whole kingdom. And over these were three presidents. Somebody say commissars or anything. It's a unique word. It doesn't occur anyplace else in the Bible. Of whom Daniel was the first, that the princes might give accounts to them and the king should suffer no damage. What we're talking about here is tax revenue. We want to make sure that the king gets all that all that's coming in, that there is there's no pilfering. We have no bribes being taken. We have, no skimming. We want to make sure that everything is as it should be. Daniel, being a character who is utterly and completely above reproach and had demonstrated that for many, many years. Now understand, he is over 80 years old at this time. Daniel's over 80. And he was in retirement in chapter 5. He's brought out of retirement for the new administration. And in verse 3 it says, then this Daniel was preferred above the presidents and princes because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king sought to set him over the whole realm. I'm going to make him the prime minister. He is so good, he is so trustworthy, that I'm going to make him the prime minister. Now, as is the case very much today, and has always been the case, when you're dealing you have political jockeying. People want the prestige, they want the power, because if I have the prestige and the power and the influence and so on, I also get money and all the other things. So the lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and the pride of life are all rolled into one when we get to this kind of thing. And when you have this kind of thing also, especially if you have a guy that won't allow anybody else that's under him to cheat. Daniel's above reproach. Daniel cannot be bribed. And so the guys that are working under him will have to be honest or they will lose their jobs or get in trouble. Which is going to affect their bottom line because, as you know, most places around the world are run by bribes. Most places are. So the presidents and the princes sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the kingdom. We're going to try to find some dirt on Daniel. Gee, where have we heard that before? Let's see if we can find some dirt on this politician or some dirt on this politician so we can discredit them so that we can get them out of the running for the presidency or the governorship or whatever the case may be. If we can find some dirt, if we can come up with a big enough scandal, then maybe we can get him out of the way and allow ourselves to be promoted in his place. But it says they could find none occasion nor fault. This is one of the, you know, the guy's 80 years old. He's been around for a long time. He's got a long record that is impeccable. None occasion, no fault, for as much as he was faithful. Neither was there any error or fault found in him. There's no bookkeeping issues or difficulties along the way. The guy is just spotless, impeccable, and really good at what he does. Then said these men, we shall... Now, this is their private intrigues, as they have their private meetings and discuss this amongst themselves. We shall not find any occasion against this Daniel, except we find concerning the law of his God. Now, understand, Daniel is the oddball. All the rest of these guys are a bunch of pagans. They are more than happy to worship lots of gods. In human history, it has been generally standard, if you are in a polytheistic society where they believe there's a lot of gods, it is generally allowed and acceptable and even promoted the idea of the more the merrier. If you were to visit, anybody here visited Rome before? Anybody here been to Rome? If you go, I haven't been there, but if you go to Rome, one of the best buildings to see from the Roman era that's still standing is the Pantheon. And it's an incredible building. It's got a great big huge dome. It's still the largest dome of that kind in the world, and it's 2,000 years old. Pantheon. What does that? It's a temple to what? The gods, plural. The more the merrier. And it's not dedicated to one particular god, it's to the gods in general. The pan, that means all. When we dealt with the word all things in this morning's service, the Greek word there is where we get our word panacea. The idea of pan means all. If we have something that remember Pan Am Airlines? Okay, all right, same idea. So we have, where was I going? I got lost on this. Pantheon, thank you. So here we have Daniel, he's the odd guy. Jews have, in ancient times, were considered weirdos and oddballs because they not only worship one God, but they would only acknowledge that there was only one God. That all the rest of the gods out there are fabrications of the human mind. They don't exist. There is only one God. And so the Jews were the oddballs. And they also maintained a measure of separation from those that were around them. And so Daniel's religion is very well known. He does not participate in the festivals and so on of everything that's going on around him. He is the odd man out. And they know that he is very devoted to his God. He does not waver on this, and so they think, if we're going to catch Daniel on anything, it's going to be something involving his God. Because his fidelity to his God is just as impeccable as his government service. And if we can find a conflict between his devotion to his God and his devotion to the government, then we've got him. Which is the trick they're going to play. Verse 6. Then these presidents and princes, by the way, this is not necessarily all of the princes would be the satraps, is a Persian word, and it would be the governors of all the different little provinces. Newer translations will sometimes use the word satrap. It's the guys who would be local there in Babylon. They're not going out to the far reaches of the empire and gathering everybody together for this giant meeting of intrigue. No, they're just using the local guys. They don't need the rest of the guys. These presidents and princes assembled together to the king and said unto him, O King Darius, live forever. Standard introductory protocol. We see this with the other guys. All the presidents of the kingdom, that's a lie. Daniel has been excluded. Daniel is not part of this. Daniel is probably unaware of any of this going on from what we'll see a little bit later on. Almost certainly he's ignorant of this intrigue that's going on. All the presidents of the kingdom, the governors, the princes, he's talking, conveying the idea that everybody in the whole empire is aboard with this, have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whosoever shall ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days, save of thee, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the decree, sign the writing, that it may not be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not. And wherefore, King Darius signed the writing and the decree. Okay. Why on earth would he do this? And what exactly is this? This does not mean that if I'm moving a piano, I can't ask somebody to help me move the piano. That's not what this is entailing. In Old Testament times, whether we're talking about, with the Jews or otherwise, you had a priesthood. If in paganism you had a priesthood, generally speaking, people did not go directly to the god or goddess. And in ancient Israel, people for the most part did, that we had there was a priesthood. A priest is a mediator. And so for a month, Darius will be the mediator, the divine mediator. He will be the priest for the empire, is primarily the idea here. Again, why would he do this? Why would he do this? Well, of course, we are stroking ego. That he is the highest and greatest, and no one can come to the gods except through him. But there's also something else. The Romans were very adept at this, in that they would blend government and religion. And that if we have a devotion to the emperor, we have a devotion to the government, and since we have a new administration here, this is something that is going to play up the devotion to the king and to the new administration. So it isn't just ego. It very likely has some idea of building fidelity to the new administration. Let's get everybody aboard. This is very similar to why, in part, Nebuchadnezzar probably had that image in chapter 3 and had everybody bow before that. A very similar type approach. That we're going to get everybody together. The idea of freedom of religion is a new thing in world history. All right. For the most part, people would be bound by something in particular. We want conformity. We want uniformity on this. We want everybody on the same page, all working together, and that includes the mode of worship and so forth. Daniel's a Jew. He's not going to go with this. Now remember, Darius wants, no, he knows Daniel. I don't think he was thinking too far ahead, because sometimes if you can get a guy all excited about something, he'll commit himself to something without thinking about the repercussions. Politicians are especially adept at this. I was talking to Leo before about how they get together and they think, how can we fix this problem? And sometimes the problem isn't really a problem. It's just a problem that they think is a problem. And they come up with a solution and they implement the solution. They put everything in place. And very often the solution is worse than the problem was in the first place because they were short-sighted. They didn't think about the implications that if I do this, then we got this, and then we got this, and we got this. And by the way, the problems that we deal with today, political and so on, are nothing new. This is standard operating procedure for politicians, all right? Common sense needs to be left at the door when you go into quote-unquote public service. He's not thinking, which for a king is a pretty risky thing. By the way, this is another plug that it was probably Cyaxares or Cyaxares, depending on how you pronounce it, that was the guy, because historically the little information that we have on him is that he was not necessarily the sharpest tool in the drawer. He signs the thing. Now, he is oblivious to the whole Daniel thing. He knows who Daniel is. He wants this guy to be his president, but he has not put two and two together that this is going to be a big problem for Daniel. Signs the decree and the writing. Now, when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he finds out after the fact. He can't come in and fix it now that it's been done. The Persian law can't be changed. Once it's been signed, once his signet has been pressed into the wax or the clay or whatever they used, it's there. And you cannot change it. You cannot change it. Daniel knew that the writing was signed. He went into his house. His windows being opened in his chamber toward Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he did aforetime. He's doing what he has always done. It is probably a roof chamber, a little cooler up there. They would have latticed windows and so forth. And he opened them and he prayed. It says toward Jerusalem. Where would he get that? Is there some place in the Old Testament scriptures where it talks about praying toward Jerusalem? I see a hand out there. Yes, over here. All right. Solomon's dedicatory prayer for the temple. And he's dealing with those who were carried away captive and so forth in that prayer. So Daniel is following through on what Solomon has said. He is praying toward Jerusalem, and he's doing this three times a day. And he's on his knees, even in his 80s, he's on his knees. And he prays and gives thanks before God as he did aforetime. He knows it's been signed, and he's going to go ahead and do the right thing, even if it costs being thrown into the den of lions. Knowing that the law can't be changed, this is going to be the outcome. He goes there knowing that this is probably what's going to happen. I also think that Daniel was probably a sharp enough guy that he understood that the whole thing was a plot to get him. And then these over-eager, it's kind of interesting. One of the things that as you read through this chapter, you see the Daniel's enemies just seem to be over-eager about this whole thing, which is going to come against them before it's all over. These men assembled. They go to Daniel's house, probably at the first opportunity, after the thing is signed, knowing that Daniel does this like clockwork. They assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. They came into his house, maybe even stormed in the house, climbed up the stairs, and there he is, praying. How dare he? He is defying the king. Who would have thought such a thing? Of course they did. It's the purpose of the whole thing. And again, over-eager. Then the men came near and spake before the king. They go from one place to the other. We got him. And you can imagine the perspiration running down their faces as they're standing before the king. You're never going to believe this, king.
But Daniel was praying and we caught him in the act.
No, that isn't quite how they do it. They come before the king in their finery. They come before him with all the protocols. And they back the king into a corner before they spring the trap on the king, which is not a good thing to do with a monarch that has your life in his hands. Hast thou not signed a decree that every man that shall ask a petition of any god or man within 30 days, save of thee, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? And you can see the king rather smugly sitting there saying, the thing is true according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not. Yes, 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 you must come to me. Then answered they and said before the king that Daniel, which is of the children of the captivity of Judah, of course they throw that out there not so much for identification. The king knows who Daniel is. It's the idea that he's a foreigner, which was the same thing that was thrown at Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego back in chapter 3. We have these upstart foreigners who have risen to extremely high political position, and the locals are fit to be tied over it. Daniel, which is of the children of the captivity of Judah, regardeth not thee, O king. He is defying you, nor to the decree that thou hast signed, but maketh his petition three times a day. He's praying in spite of what you've said. He is disobeying you. He is defying you. He is knowingly disobeying the law that you have signed. Looking back at chapter 3 with Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar's response was what? When they wouldn't bow.
Anger.
Yeah, he was enraged. His visage was changed. Here we have a guy, he says that when the king heard these words, he was sore displeased with himself. He'd been tricked, and he knew it. And he is going to lose something that he wants. And he knows it's his own fault because he jumped at the opportunity that the flatterers were giving instead of considering the implications of it. And he set his heart on Daniel to deliver him, and he labored until the going down of the sun to deliver him. One of the perks, pro-con, of Persian law is that it was speedy. If you were to be executed, it was the same day kind of a thing. We didn't have this long appeal process. And so we have, he's doing it that day. The sentence has to be fulfilled before sunset. And when it says he's laboring, what's he doing? He can't change what's been written. What's he looking for? He's looking for a loophole. He's got his guys there. They're looking over the decree that he signed, and also they're finding out if there are any past decrees that he's overstepped, because the previous things would overrule this thing. So he's looking for some way to get around what he has signed. Which is kind of ironic. Yes, I just passed this law, but I got to find a loophole for myself. And the over-anxious enemies of Daniel, verse 15, then the men assembled, after dinner meeting here, I'm sure, and said unto the king, know, O king, that the law of the Medes and Persians, what the law of the Medes and Persians is, that no decree or statute which the king established may be changed. And he has exhausted his options, and the clock is ticking, and the time is up. And the king commanded, and they brought Daniel, and they cast him into the den of lions. Now the king spake and said unto Daniel, thy God whom thou servest continually, he will deliver thee. probably wishful thinking on the part of Darius. He is not a worshiper of the true God. He's a pagan. Now, let's envision this. How would Nebuchadnezzar execute people? At least one of the options that we've seen. Yeah, I'm going to burn them alive. In the Persian religion, that was a no-no. The Persian religion in part was Zoroastrianism, which still exists. There's a question as to whether or not Zoroastrianism was at this point in time the main religion of the Persians, or whether they were just pagans in general. Zoroastrianism has some interesting things. You can't desecrate the soil, and so they have interesting burial rites. They let the vultures deal with it. They put you someplace and let the birds pick your bones clean, and then they'll take care of the bones later. So if we're going to execute somebody, I can't burn them alive. I'm limited, and so we'll just feed them to something else. And so we have the lions. Now, 2,500 years ago, lions were found from India to and throughout all of Africa except the deepest jungles and the driest deserts. They were also found in Turkey and throughout the Middle East. The last Middle Eastern lions were wiped out during World War II. The proliferation of firearms is what wiped out lions. There are still about 600 lions in India in one preserve. And the reason they're still there is that was a Maharaja's private hunting preserve, and the lions survived there because they were reserved for him. And they're still there. Now, if you were to look at an Indian lion next to an African lion, are there some differences? Yes. But at a glance, would you be able to tell which one? If I didn't tell you what the differences were, would you be able to pick out which one was which? No. They're about the same size. They still have the manes. They have there's just three minor differences, and it's a lion, okay? And they can freely interbreed with African lions. They've done so in zoos and so on. Sorry, lions. When you're dealing with a den of lions, and they have actually found, I think, a couple of these from what I read, what you've got is you've got a walled in, some said it was a cave, but if we're dealing with a palace situation, it's probably a walled in thing, where you've got walls that are 15 to 20 feet high. You have two large rooms. One of the rooms, perhaps the size of this room. And then you would have a doorway with a gate, a metal gate, and then another room of approximately the same size. Because if you have this in proximity to a palace or anything else, what is something you have to do? You have to clean this thing out from time to time, otherwise the smell gets a little thick. And so what you do is you throw some meat into one side, the lions come running in to eat the meat, you drop the gate, you clean out the other side, and you go back and forth and keep the thing straightened up. You would have to have an entrance, a gateway, someplace on ground level to be able to take a cart in there and so on to do some of that stuff. But it says that they were, from the description here, when they threw a prisoner in there, they had sort of like a big manhole or something up at the top where they could either lower somebody, and I dare say that they probably lowered Daniel. The guy's 80 years old. From the ceiling to the floor has to be far enough so a lion can't jump out of the hole. Cats can jump. A lion can probably jump, a young, especially the ladies, can probably jump about 10 or 12 feet up. Easily. Our mountain lions here can have a 16-foot vertical jump. So I doubt they threw Daniel in there because the fall would have killed the guy at 80 probably. So they probably lowered him down. And when they took him out, they would have had to have done the same thing. So they have the den of the lions down below. They keep the lions relatively hungry. Otherwise, they're not going to do what they're supposed to do. Lions... Most of the big cats, but especially lions and tigers, are known to be man-eaters.
Tigers especially are one of the very few animals that looks at people and says, lunch. Tigers and polar bears, and occasionally grizzly bears, are among the very few land animals that look at people and think, there's a meal for me. And lions to a lesser degree. And if they are kept hungry, not a problem. Especially since firearms are not in existence here, and therefore their fear of people is a little less than it has developed to be in recent centuries. A den of lions. Conjecture, how many lions? One of the writers said, oh, there's probably 40 in here. It's a guess. But there's enough of them to do the job without any trouble, difficulty, especially when we get to the end of the chapter and we're talking about multiple victims. Daniel is lowered into the den of lions. Again, kept hungry enough so that they're definitely interested in whatever comes down through the door. And then they put a stone over the door, like a manhole cover, and it's sealed by the signet of the king and the nobles. So they all have to be present in order to have the seal broken. This makes sure that the king doesn't cheat and the nobles don't cheat. Because they want to make sure that Daniel doesn't get killed. If the lions don't do it, that one of the nobles doesn't come in here and do it during the night, shooting him with an arrow or something. And so he is put into the den of lions. And a stone was brought and laid over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his signet, with his own signet, and the signet of his lords, that the purpose should not be changed concerning Daniel. The law is being fulfilled. He had to be thrown or placed into the den of lions. By the way, do you know that the whole idea of being sentenced to be hanged, they had to add a phrase to that. Hanged until dead. Because if you had somebody that was really strong and they wanted to have the guy survive, they could do that, hang him for a second or two, and then take him down and he'd be okay. Maybe a little rope burn or something like that, but he'd be able to survive. So we have to throw in till dead thing here. Daniel has to be put into the lion's den. I don't think anybody figured that he'd survive. The king went to his palace, passed the night fasting. He doesn't do what he normally does. Neither were instruments of music brought to him, and his sleep went from him. He's got too much on his mind. And the king arose very early in the morning. He's going to be there. Crack of dawn. The law has been fulfilled. And just in case, the most unlikely scenario as far as he's concerned actually came to pass, that Daniel is still alive. If I get there at break of day, I can get him out of there, having fulfilled the law. The king rose very early in the morning, went in haste to the den of the lions, and he came to the den, and he cried with a lamentable voice unto Daniel, and the king spake and said, O Daniel, servant of the living God, is thy God, whom thou servest continually, able to deliver thee from the lions? Now, you know what's interesting? I didn't realize this until I studied this chapter, I was reviewing this. The first 20 verses of this chapter, does Daniel say anything? No. All the talking is done by the political enemies and the king. And we don't have Daniel speak until verse 21. And he doesn't say much. He says unto the king, O king, live forever. Standard protocols. He doesn't say, hey, get me out of here! O king, live forever. And in the same breath he says, my God hath sent his angel and has shut the lions' mouths, and they have not hurt me, for as much as before him innocency was found in me, and also before thee, O king, I have done no hurt. The first thing he says is, I did not disobey my God. And then he also says, and I haven't done anything against you, O king. And by the way, that's all that we're going to see Daniel saying in this chapter. Here's another interesting thing to think of. Who fasted during the night? And the lions.
Then was the king exceedingly glad. It's twofold. Number one, he's glad that Daniel's still alive. He's glad that this guy, that a wrong was not done to this man that had lasting effect. He's glad that he's going to be able to use this guy politically to his own benefit. And also he's glad that he will, this is a big thing for a lot of people in different cultures, he's able to save face. King was exceeding glad. He commanded that they take Daniel up out of the den. And they do the same thing that we saw in chapter 3. No manner of hurt was found upon him. Everybody's gathering around to see if he's been hurt by the lions. Did anybody bite him? Did anybody scratch him? Did anything happen? I dare say Daniel had a much nicer sleep than the king did. Nice big furry pillow and... And it says, no hurt was found in him because he believed in his God. Now, again, the overeager politicians, the king knows he has been duped. He knows he was tricked into doing this. The law has been fulfilled. Here's one of the problems that you have in a situation like this, in that the king needs certain things done for the kingdom. And I've got this bunch of guys that are wicked, vile, disreputable men, but they're very capable. And if I bump these guys off, who's going to do the work that I need to have done? But Daniel survived. So I've got Daniel. And I've got the people that work under Daniel. So now, not only have these guys been exposed for what they are, and I know what they are, but now I've got Daniel back, and I don't need these guys. So he can dispose of them, and he does so. Verse 24. And the king commanded, and they brought those men which had accused Daniel, and cast, now this sounds really, I'll explain this in just a moment. They cast them into the den of lions, their children and their wives. That was Persian law. Now, the law of Moses, you only executed the guilty one. You did not execute his family, unless they were complicit in the crime. But Persian law had it otherwise. The Persians were not interested in justice. The Persians were interested in expediency. We see this with in the book of Esther, that when Haman was executed, and then we deal with the fix, who else ends up getting executed? All of his sons. Why would you want to do that? Practically speaking, I'm not talking about justice-wise, I'm talking about very practically speaking, why would you want to do that?
Get rid of the people that seek
revenge. Revenge. If I've executed the guy's dad, I got to watch out for his son. If he doesn't have any sons, I don't have to worry about it anymore. And that was the Persian way of looking at things, and that's frankly how most places around the world have operated. And it says, and the lions had mastery of them and break all their bones in pieces or ever they came to the den of the lions. If you have a cat and you have a little toy on the end of the string and they jump up, okay, can you imagine that doing that with people and big, big cats? And that's what's going on here. This also lets you know that Daniel survived not because the lions were full and not because they were old and toothless lions. It was God's intervention because the next morning, and almost immediately, within an hour, certainly, and probably a lot less than that, after Daniel comes out, these people go in. Same lions. And the response is very, very different. And so they are killed. They are snatched and killed and devoured before they even have a chance to land in the bottom of the den. Verse 25. Then Darius does the same thing that Nebuchadnezzar did. Wrote unto all people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth. This would be within the confines of his realm, of course, but this is how they spoke in those things. Peace be multiplied unto you. I make a decree. Now, got to be careful with these decrees. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and steadfast forever, and his kingdom, that which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion is even unto the end. He delivereth and he rescueth, and he worketh signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who hath delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. And so Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. And again, dealing with the identification, we can't have them be, some would say even Darius the Persian, they'll try to tweak the language a little bit, having referred to the same guy. I think they were different guys. I think that the Cyaxares thing is the most likely, or it's something we don't know yet. But, and Cyaxares, died about between 18 months and 2 years after Babylon was taken. So he doesn't have a long time before Cyrus comes in and takes over the whole thing. And Daniel was involved in the government, into the beginning of the reign of Cyrus the Persian. All right, any questions or anything on what we've looked at here tonight?
One question.
Yes, sir.
Cyrus, was he the one that gave Nehemiah the command?
Yes. No. No. He's the one that told Zerubbabel to go back and rebuild the temple.
Zerubbabel?
Zerubbabel.
Oh, Zerubbabel. Oh.
At the end of the 70-year captivity,
yeah,
when the command by the Persian king was to the Jews to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild their temple, Cyrus was the one that made that decree.
Okay, same guy. All right.
Yeah.
All right. All right.
Nehemiah would have been quite a few years later. And that's like 4 or 5 kings later.
Oh, okay.
Matter of fact, Nehemiah chronologically is, along with, they're about the same time. Nehemiah and Malachi are the last books of the Old Testament as far as sequences, time sequence is concerned.
Okay.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Do you think verses 26 through 27 have the kind of speech that Christ gives as an acknowledgement of God, like saving faith in him?
Was it, what we have in verses 26 and 27, is that like saving faith? Is that a confession by Darius? And I would say we don't know. I mean, with the limited information here, I would say probably not. But it's a recognition anyway. Now, whether or not it's saving faith and he's embracing the God of Daniel, I don't know. But there's certainly a recognition of the God of Daniel. That here we have a God, again, a God who does things. Nebuchadnezzar makes a similar decree after the fiery furnace thing. But we don't see him broken until the end of chapter 4, and that's over 20 years later.
I think he makes a decree before that, before the furnace too, when Daniel reveals his dream.
He honors Daniel, but he doesn't necessarily get, I'll have to double check, but you may be right. But anyway, but we don't see him broken until toward the end of his life, at the end of chapter 4. Yes, sir.
So rather than saving faith, maybe it's more saving faith, that he's acknowledging that, you know, even though that there is a power out there that is able to basically
blunt one of his... See, Nebuchadnezzar said the same thing. There aren't any other gods that can rescue after this kind of thing. And so here we have a God that is, I'm not denying the existence of all these other gods, but I'm saying here's a God who does stuff that other gods don't do. And so the exaltation of this God, there's recognition and at least lip service worship, but whether or not he's putting his personal trust in this God, doesn't say. All right, anything else? All right, let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you for your word. Father, thank you that you rule in the kingdoms of men. And Father, when we see the world in turmoil and so on, we sometimes get frightened and worried and perhaps angry over what's going on. But Father, ultimately you are in control. And Father, what you have decreed will eventually come to pass. Father, thank you that you have kept humanity from destroying themselves up to this time. And Father, thank you that this, what we see today, is really nothing new. And going back here and looking at the days of the Persians, political intrigue, self-serving, murder, and so on, were not beyond people seeking to climb to power and prestige. And Father, may we recognize that it's your hand that keeps things as good as they are. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.